From WWNO, this is Music Inside Out. I'm Gwen Tompkins. This and every week we talk to people in Louisiana who've devoted their lives to music. We want to hear about their experiences and listen to what they're listening to, because that's where our music comes from. This week, jazz trumpeter and singer Jeremy Davenport. From Harry Connick Jr. sideman to headliner at the Ritz-Carlton in New Orleans.
But I remember this really serious conversation I had with Harry once. You know, he sat me down and he said, "Let me get this straight. You'd rather sing in a hotel than travel the world with me." And I looked at him dead in the eye and I said, "Yeah, I would."
Jeremy Davenport's Sentimental Journey, after the news. This is Music Inside Out. I'm Gwen Tompkins. In music, the Great American Songbook is the equivalent of the U.S. Army Survival Manual. Both books can get you through the toughest periods of your life. And at the same time, they remind us just how terrific it is to be alive. Jeremy Davenport has made his life's work sifting through the standards and trying to create a few of his own. Today, he's blowing his trumpet solo, as you can hear on his version of the Harold Arlen classic, "I've Got a Right to Sing the Blues." But truth be told, how blue can a man be who lives and works at the Ritz-Carlton Hotel in New Orleans? That's where we are and where he is. Thanks for having us over.
Nice to see you.
And do you validate parking?
I do. I carry the stamp in my back pocket.
Yes, yeah. I'm Jeremy Davenport. I validate.
I validate parking. Yeah, wow.
Now, let's start at the beginning. You are from St. Louis. Your dad was a trombonist, classical trombonist. He was with the St. Louis Symphony for, what, 40 years?
Almost 50 years.
Yeah. And your mother, a music teacher, who also taught for like 50 years.
About the same. They kind of went out of the game at the same time, so they retired together, basically. Yeah.
If I walked into the Davenport house when you were a kid, what would I be hearing?
The older I get, the more I realize it was a super unique environment to grow up in. Obviously, as a kid, you don't. It's all you know.
I'm Dave Sinclair.
Until I grew up and started spending time in other people's houses, did I realize how incredibly great and bizarre at the same time. And so my folks, first of all, they're both kind of accomplished piano players. They both can play piano.
Really?
And then my mom is a singer and plays guitar and dulcimer, and she's definitely like the hippie, you know, "Hey, lighty, lighty, lighty." You know? And so my mom exposed me to, like, you know, the Bee Gees, Sly and the Family Stone.
child grows up to be somebody that just loves to learn at all.
I look back on it now, it's crazy. She very much had her finger kind of on the pulse of like the current pop music scene in the 70s, and she continues to do that now, and it's, you know, 2012, my mom's interested in everything that's on the radio. It's crazy. And then my dad, obviously a very serious classical trombonist. But then had a really, really serious passion for jazz. And so my dad turned me on to Miles Davis, Louis Armstrong, Clark Terry, all the greats. So at a very young age, I was lucky to be exposed, you know, to. And then when people would come through St. Louis, my dad took me to Count Basie, Ella Fitzgerald, those big shows. And so I was lucky, you know.
You are lucky.
Yeah.
And so when you're talking about your mom, though, and she's introducing you to, you know, music going from the Bee Gees to Sly and the Family Stone, I mean, let's talk about the Bee Gees for a minute there. I mean, oftentimes, because of their success with Saturday Night Fever, their music, the wealth of music that they created, you know, I mean, oftentimes gets pushed aside. You know, people think that, you know, it's, I mean, not to say there's anything wrong with disco, but they think of the Bee Gees as a disco act.
Right.
But the truth of the matter is, they sang a heck of a lot more than that.
No, they did. And a similar act to me, not to change the subject from the Bee Gees, but no, like, the older I got and started to really research, like, Hall & Oates, I'm like, wow, they did a lot of stuff, you know? So, yeah, my mom definitely was interested in you know, that genre. And so, yeah, the Bee Gees, I mean, she had everything they recorded, and it was around the house, and it was, you know, Stevie Wonder always. I mean, she was into it, and she actually taught, I mean, I remember, I'll give you a perfect example. When I was a kid, I mean, my mom was my you know, I don't want to say choir, general music teacher in grade school. And like in 1978, maybe, we're doing Styx, Come Sail Away, in the school, in a public school in St. Louis. And my mom's like playing the Rhodes with bell bottoms on. You know, I see pictures now and I'm like, man, my mom was hip, you know?
Your mom is so Mrs. Partridge.
Totally.
I'm sailing away. Set an open course for the virgin sea. 'Cause I've got to free to face the life that's ahead of me. On board, I'm the captain, so climb aboard. We'll search for tomorrow on every shore, and I'll try, oh Lord, I'll try to carry on. We had, we lived happily forever, so the story goes. But somehow we missed out on the pot of gold. But we'll try.
Some of my earliest memories of music were like Peter Frampton Comes Alive.
Great album.
And I used to do like air guitar. I'd wear, now this is really weird. I can't remember the song off the bat. It was the one where he.
Not Do You Know How It Feels?
No. It's Why don't you show me the way? Bow, 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 bow.
Every day.
That's the song. I would steal my mom's like tights or pantyhose, and I'd put them on, and it was like this weird like. And as a kid, I had long blonde hair. And
curly?
Curly long blonde
nice.
Hair. And I would play air guitar. My parents had this landing that was kind of like a stage, and I remember hardwood floors sliding around to that song. So that there it is.
And
there
never have your parents been more proud. Our guest this week is Jeremy Davenport. Still to come, life as a sideman with Harry Connick Jr. Stay with us. This is Music Inside Out. I'm Gwen Tompkins. This week, we're visiting with Jeremy Davenport.
I want to be a sideman, just an ordinary sideman. I'll go along for the ride, man, responsibility free. I want to fill behind the vocal, double on flute, and jam on the blues. I want to go and join the local, buy a dark suit, start paying dues.
Hey, you leave St. Louis at the age of 18, you head to New York.
Mm-hmm.
You're in New York for a little while, and then you ended up joining the Harry Connick Jr. band.
Right.
And touring with him for several years.
Uh-huh.
Let's talk about being a sideman,
okay?
Is it like that Count Basie song, you know, the one Rosemary Clooney sings, I Want to Be a Sideman? Have you ever heard it?
No.
You gotta hear that
but,
song.
Oh, I got to.
Yeah.
I want to work for a superstar. I want to hang in the hotel bar. I want to be young. I want to have fun. I want to be a side man.
And so, well, what's it like then, since you know firsthand?
Okay, well, I can just tell you first, for me, again, back to one of these experiences, at the time I didn't think much of it, but I was certainly thankful and loved the fact that I was getting paid and playing music that I loved. So with that aside, the magical part was when I got that gig, I just turned 19.
Wow.
And so all of a sudden I was surrounded by musicians, and most importantly, New Orleans musicians that were much more advanced than me in years and in experience and in level. I mean, I got to sit next to Leroy Jones, who is still one of my favorite trumpeters. And it's funny, we just texted each other yesterday because I still think about him a lot. That experience right there was priceless for me. So, you know, being a sideman for me meant being able to listen to Leroy and play with Leroy every night, and then also get the opportunity to play, and so for me, I would never change that experience for anything, just because it was valuable. And then another interesting component of it was, during that time, I mean, we were playing venues that were not necessarily jazz venues.
Really?
I mean, we were playing in, at the time, this is when Harry's career really took off, and we were playing in venues that were huge. And so all of a sudden, I was a kid going, "Oh wow, this is unbelievable!"
Because you mean like when he was at the Kennedy Center and that
stuff like
stuff?
That? Yeah, we did the Kennedy Center like three different times. We did. It was unbelievable. I look back at it now, and it was like, it was an experience for me, because as a young kid, it was inspiring to see people show up to hear standards and hear American songbook stuff and jazz, quite frankly. So for me, it was totally inspiring. But at the same time, I learned very kind of early into it that my ego was not going to lend itself to being a sideman. So back to the Rosemary Clooney song, I was like, no, I want to be the person.
Talk about that. Tell us about that. I mean, because at a certain point, for so many artists, ultimately they find the sideman role confining.
Yeah.
No matter how great the band is.
Oh, totally, totally. I mean, and again, I was, I started getting the itch. I was probably 21 years old when I was like, man, this is great, but I want my own gig. And Harry was helpful with me. I mean, with that experience, I was kind of thrust into these situations where I got to meet people, which came, that's how my record deal came up, around. I mean, they knew me as the, I played trumpet with Harry Connick Jr., da-da-da-da. So I got noticed.
Just kiss me and forget all about that other stuff. Kiss me, your big red lips I think will be enough. Don't worry with your lipstick, I'm gonna kiss it all away. Throw away your lipstick, that ain't your color anyway. Me. I've got to know just how much you miss me. Kiss me, and I'll take your lips to paradise. Kiss me, and paradise will never feel so nice. You're beautiful, you don't need all that makeup, and you don't need to take up sugar all of your time in front of the mirror. Can't you see that you're my dear up? Baby, can't you see we're in love?
I remember this really serious conversation I had with Harry once, where basically, you know, he sat me down and he said, let me get this straight. He goes, you'd rather sing in a hotel than travel the world with me. And I looked at him dead in the eye and I said, yeah, I would. And that was that moment of me saying, hey, as much as I love him and I love him like a brother, and as much as I love the opportunity, at the time, it was more important for me to do my own thing with my own band on a totally different scale, but to start chasing that dream as opposed to staying in his band and doing that.
So and
that
chasing was his dream.
Exactly. Yes. Exactly. But that's a difficult conversation to have, man. I remember that very vividly, you know.
I believe it. There's so many stories about artists, sidemen, famous sidemen, who leave bands. Mm-hmm. There's that one great, I don't know if it's apocryphal, but there's a great story about Ben Webster when he left Ellington. Mm-hmm. They had a big fight. He reportedly cut up one of Ellington's suits.
Right. Yeah.
Just rolled out of there, you know. Yeah. So you didn't cut up.
No. My departure. No. Actually, he was just here, and he's still one of my heroes. I mean, it's so funny because now, you know, I think he's 4 years older than me. But as you get older, that 4 years doesn't mean anything. When you're a kid, that 4 years means something, you know. So yeah, when I started working with Harry, I was a kid, but he was just a little bit of an older kid. And now we laugh. We're like, man, we're old, you know. But super peaceful and. You know, much love and respect to him. He's a dear friend.
So tell us about that moment when you were free, when you walked out of, you walked away from this band, mm-hmm. you know, the Connick band, and started your own thing. What mm-hmm. was the first thing that you did? First thing on your mind, first thing that you did as an artist?
At the time, and I can't remember the exact timing of it, but I got a record deal, so I was writing my own music, and I was recording, and I was thinking about myself. I was thinking about, okay, what am I going to do? How can I share this music that I love with people? What am I going to do? You know, what kind of format? Am I going to try and do a big band? What am I going to do? You know,
yeah.
I was seriously searching for conceptually what it was that I was chasing.
This is the end of a beautiful friendship. It ended a moment ago. This is the end of a beautiful friendship. I know, for your eyes told me so. We were always like sister and brother until tonight when we looked at each other. This is the end of a beautiful friendship and just the beginning of love.
that process of writing music, practicing the trumpet, practicing singing, learning new songs, practicing the piano, all those things. I do that every single day.
So tell us about your daily constitutional. What do you, when you pick up your trumpet for the first time every day, I don't know if you sing, play the same song or if you play what? What do you do?
Well, I it's funny because, and for people that know me, I'm a creature of habit. I'm neurotic. which I'm not proud of. So I actually have to force myself to change it up. It's almost like you read about, you know, when you're doing a physical fitness thing, you have to force yourself to change your routine. Your mind and your muscles are very efficient, and they learn how to adapt. So for me, I do a number of things. I just there's a few things I want to touch on every day, and so yeah, you work on the technical part of trumpet playing, the tone, I want to make sure I always have a very pretty sound. That's something that never goes away, and that comes from, you know, listening to other trumpet players, and you go, man, that guy's sound is haunting. It's beautiful, you know, and then you try to, it's back to the drawing board and try to figure out sound. And so,
did you practice today?
I did.
What'd you play? You want to play it for us?
Well, yeah. Okay. I'll give you a perfect example of what I did this morning.
Okay.
There's a song called Taking a Chance on Love. It's an old standard.
Very nice song.
Yeah. And so I like to look at the original source of how was it harmonically structured, because a lot of times the pop tunes, even from the 30s, 40s, and 50s, it went through this period where people started to reharmonize standards.
Yeah.
And we've gotten long enough now. I like to go back to the original resource and figure out what exactly was Cole Porter thinking when he sat down and did this tune. So kind of strip it down, go back to the bare kind of minimum skeletal structures of the tune. And then what I'll do is, so I'll give you an example of that tune. You know, the interesting component of being a either a singing trumpet or a trumpet playing singer, however, whoever wants to call me which. And this is something Mr. Marsalis, Ellis Marsalis, told me when I first got to New Orleans, when he's like, I played a tune for him, and he goes, you know, that's great, but do you know the words? Because it's a beautiful song. Do you know what the song's about? I said, absolutely not. I have no idea. He goes, learn this, learn the words. So in this situation, I'll play it for you first,
okay,
and then I'll give you kind of an example of, I'm kind of, in my mind, if this makes sense, I'm playing the melody, but I'm also in my mind singing the words.
Good. Okay.
And so it's kind of a weird process. It's a dual practice, if you will.
Okay.
Here I go again, I hear the trumpet blow again, all aglow again, taking a chance on love. Here I slide again, about to take that ride again, starry-eyed again, taking a chance on love. So, again, my interpretation is slightly different vocally than trumpet-wise, but I like to bounce phrasing ideas off each other, and so that's the way I spend hours and hours a day doing that with different songs, learning. And that's a song that I learned it a long, long time ago, and I'm putting it back in my songbook just because I heard a version of it recently, and I'm like, I love that song. Plus,
good,
it's
for you.
The lyric, here I go again, I hear the trumpet blow again. I love that. I mean,
it's
to
true.
Me, it's sweet.
You know? And it's, but you're facing a tough task because, for instance, that song is often associated with Ella Fitzgerald, for instance,
true,
who's got a great vocal on it.
True.
You know, it is hard to make it your own.
I hear those trumpets blow again, all aglow again, taking a chance on love. Here I slide again, about to take that ride again, starry-eyed again, taking a chance on love.
Ella Fitzgerald. Who else could it be? Still to come, boy meets girl, over and over and over again. Stay with us. This is Music Inside Out. I'm Gwen Tompkins. Not long ago, jazz pianist David Torkanowski was on the show, and he did a little trash talking about Jeremy Davenport.
I read the Keith Spira book, Groove Interrupted. You two, Jeremy Davenport and yourself, you are characterized or self-characterized as self-loathers.
Meaning we're hypercritical. And I would say I'm in the minor leagues in that category, and he is in the Smithsonian in that category.
When I take my sugar to tea, all the boys are jealous of me, 'cause I never take her where the gang goes when I take my sugar to tea.
Keith Spira really succeeded in capturing just how advanced Jeremy's anal retention is.
I will save my Torkanowski analysis for a later broadcast.
This is your shot, Mr.
Yeah,
Davenport.
No.
This is it.
I love David, and I won't speak on him publicly. He has a wonderful family and reputation to protect.
No, this is a man who plays songs called Stoop Down Baby and Let Your Daddy See.
I do not believe
that this is a guy who has tender feelings.
When I take my sugar to tea, I'm as ritzy as I could be, 'cause I never take her where the gang goes when I take my sugar to tea. When I take my sugar to tea.
All the music, basically, that I've recorded or have been interested in over the years is love songs.
True.
I mean, really, like, romantic, kind of straight-ahead, boy meets girl, walked in the park, do the thing, you know. And that's been kind of my interest. And recently, I've been trying to think about, you know, is there any other subject matter that I might be able to incorporate in my songwriting? Because that has been that has definitely driven my songwriting, just because I've been in love with those songs.
Yeah.
You know, the American Songbook, you know, I would say probably 99% of those songs are about what I just said. They're romantic vignettes or little stories of boy meets girl, okay? And so recently, you know, so I'll give you a perfect example. There's a guy, and I just learned this yesterday. This guy is from New Orleans. His stage name is Frank Ocean, but he's an R&B singer, songwriter. And
he's just come out with a CD, hasn't he?
Yeah. Just released a CD. What I find truly fascinating about him is he's writing these songs. And again, I've been sitting on this recording for 2 days now. I have no idea what he's talking about. I mean, literally, his songwriting.
It is in English, right?
It is English.
A tornado flew around my room before you came. Excuse the mess it made. It usually doesn't rain in Southern California, much like Arizona. My eyes don't shed tears, but boy, they pour when I'm thinking about you. Oh, no, no, no. I've been thinking about you. You, no, no, no. I've been thinking about you. Do you think about me still? Do you? Or do you not think so far ahead? 'Cause I've been thinking about forever. You were cool enough to kick it. Got a beach house I could sell you in Idaho. Since you think I don't love you, I just thought you were cute. That's why I kiss you. Got a fighter jet, I don't get to fly it, though I'm lying down thinking about you. Oh, no, no, no. I've been thinking about you. You, no, no, no. I've been thinking about you. Do you think about me still? Do you? Or do you not think so far ahead? 'Cause I've been thinking about forever.
And it makes sense. And as soon as I go, oh, it is like he's alluding to this. And I'm like, no, he's not alluding to that. So I listen to that and I go, how free would that be to be able to write music that's just, you know, he must be so inspired that he can basically write about everything. And man, I'd like to tap into that kind of energy, you know, because for so long, I mean, I just keep coming back to these boy meet girl songs.
Exactly. Wow. Well, so let me ask you this. Now, you have described your relationship with Wynton Marsalis in a very interesting way. There's a similarity to your relationship as you describe it to the way that Louis Armstrong described his relationship with King Oliver, in the sense that Armstrong would always say, you know, no matter where we were on the street in New Orleans, if I asked Oliver how to do something, he would stop right there and he would play it for me.
Right.
And he would show me how it's done. And although there were lots of other wonderful musicians around New Orleans at that time when Armstrong was young, Oliver was the only one who would stop and show kids what to do.
Yeah. When I was 13, he tried to encourage me to come down at that age to study with his dad. I have three conversations between he and I that I recorded when I was really young. Yeah. And essentially, they're like hour-long trumpet lessons on the phone.
Wow.
And I look back on that now, and every day I try. I want to be as gracious and as generous with my time as he was with his.
Can you talk a little bit about some of the great technical advice he gave you?
Yeah.
Give us an example.
Well, I was playing a Clifford Brown trumpet solo for him. And at the time, I guess, my vibrato, listening back on it, was kind of like, and I'm playing this thing for Wynton, and Wynton goes, yeah, Folly, you sound like a mariachi trumpet player. And I remember, like, I didn't know what a mariachi trumpet player was, you know? And he's like, you're going, pa 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 pa. He's like, and so my point is, that's simply just one thing.
Well, show us how you did it again.
Right.
And then once you had that very cutting conversation with Mr. Marsalis,
yeah, okay.
How you learned to play it. That same riff.
So So that would be like the mariachi. And I don't know where that came from.
With all due respect to mariachis.
Yeah, oh, definitely.
Yes, okay, go ahead.
It's stylistically incredible. Not in the context of trying to like play a hip jazz solo.
Okay.
So with that in mind, this, you know, as opposed to just more of a straight tone, or if you are going to play with a vibrato, like more expressive, like back to like. And now we're getting into the nuts and bolts of style, and I don't want to give away all my secrets, but
thank you, Fred.
No, but make
thank
it more
you, Freddie Keppert.
Yeah, but make it more vocal. And it's so funny. Do I want my trumpet to sound more like a voice, or do I want my voice to sound more like a trumpet?
There's a small hotel with a wishing well. I wish that we were there together. There's a bridal suite, one room bright and neat, complete for us to share together. Looking through the window, you can see a distant steeple, not a sign of people. Who wants people? When the steeple bell says good night, sleep well, we'll thank the small hotel. We'll creep into our little shell, and we will thank the small hotel together. ¶¶
You do a lovely version of Moonglow.
Yeah.
Would you mind playing a little bit for
sure.
us? And so when you sing it though,
yeah, it must have been moon glow, way up in the blue. It must have been moon glow that led me straight to you. I still hear you saying, dear one, hold me fast, and I start in praying. Oh, Lord, please let this last.
It's beautiful.
Thank you. I appreciate it.
We're very grateful. Thank you.
Thank you. If you start to get comfortable with, like, yeah, I'm the best trumpet player in the building right now. Yeah.
You certainly are the best in this room.
I guarantee I'm the best trumpet player at this table right now.
Jeremy Davenport appears weekends at the Davenport Lounge in the Ritz-Carlton, New Orleans. Get here early if you want one of those big, comfy couches. Next time on Music Inside Out. Sonny Landreth isn't much bigger than his slide guitar, but in rock and roll, his guitar is huge. We're heading to Lafayette, Louisiana to hear from the man who even Eric Clapton wants to hear play. This is Music Inside Out. Each week, we feature the people of Louisiana who've devoted their lives to making the music we call our own. You can listen to the program anytime, on demand. Visit wwno.org for details. Our show is produced by Lynette Johnson, Jason Rhine, Lily Kieber, and Sean Collins. Our engineers are Jenny Lawson and Thomas Walsh. Jason Saul keeps the WWNO website so nice. Our theme song was composed and performed by James Booker. Ron Curtis is WWNO's operations director. Ron Biava is the station's marketing and development manager. And the general manager of WWNO is Paul Mawson. I'm Gwen Tompkins, and this is Music Inside Out. This week, the final word goes to our producer, Jason Rhine. He and his wife, Kelly, have a new baby girl, and already people are singing about her, like her dad and her Aunt Layla.
Hey, little girl, with two eyes and two ears. Hey, little girl, with a nose and a mouth that smiles. Hey, little girl, two cheeks and a chin. Hey, little girl, with that hair upon your head. You are the apple of my eye. so beautiful, my child. You are the apple of my eye. You are so beautiful, my child.
Hey, little girl, with two arms and two legs. Hey, little girl, with two hands and two feet, walking down the street.
Six, seven, eight,
nine, ten. You are the apple of my eye. You are so beautiful, my child. You are the apple of my eye. You are so beautiful, my child. So beautiful, my child.